The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online, and thank you very much for joining us. I'm Laura Kovacs, and I'm pleased to be here. Hala Alian is the author of the novel Salt Houses, which won the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, among other honors, as well as four collections of poetry, most recently the 29th year. A look at war's intergenerational legacy in the Middle East, her new work, The Arsonist's City, follows a scattered family's return to Beirut to save an ancestral home. And according to a New York Times review, when plumbing the intricacies of race and womanhood, she turns paragraphs into poetry. This evening, she'll be joined in conversation with Alex Gers, my longtime colleague and vice president of communications at the Free Library of Philadelphia. And now the screen is all yours.
Thank you so much, Laura. Thank you for being here. Hello, we're so pleased to have you.
Me too. Thank you for having me.
Of course. So I know we're going to start off this evening and you are going to read a passage from The Arsonist's City for us. So if you want to set that up and dive right in, we are all excited to hear.
Awesome. So I thank you, first of all, to the Free Library of Philadelphia. Thank you, Laura. Thank you, Alex. And thank you to everybody that's joining us tonight. It's really an honor to be here and to get to chat about this book. So I'm going to read, I guess, just a quick synopsis of the book. It's two stories kind of woven together. One is of a woman in the 60s and 70s coming of age in Damascus who dreams of moving to Hollywood and becoming a star. Ends up kind of reluctantly getting married to this Lebanese man, moving to California, and life does not turn out the way that she expects it to. She kind of ends up being like the immigrant wife, and her dreams sort of get dashed. The second story takes place in modern, present day Beirut, with the entire family, like Laura was saying, gathering, including the adult children at this point, to try to stop their father from selling their ancestral house. And this section is from Naj's chapter, and Naj is the youngest of the three children. She's 29. She's also the only one that lives in Beirut. She went for college and never went back. And part of that has to do with the fact that she's queer and has sort of put an ocean between her and her family. And she sort of lives this alternative lifestyle as a rock star and as a musician and like a lot of drugging and drinking. So I'm just gonna read this section as she's walking in the streets at night in Beirut, going home after a night out. At this hour, the city has a narcotic effect. Ambient noise drifts from the passing cabs, a French song, the sound of a man coughing, and the few people on the street share a certain camaraderie, nodding and smiling wryly at each other. Beirut is an insomniac city. Unfocused, filled with half-finished buildings and impromptu crowds. There has been a high-rise under construction on Naj's block since she bought the apartment several years ago. She'd lived in this neighborhood longer, though, since her move from America. The newer houses live dissonantly among the older, plain ones. The city doesn't change so much from neighborhood to neighborhood as much as from building to building, and Naj is tired of remembering the former incarnations of places. The spa that was once a fabric store, the health food market that was once filled with antiques and toys. Her own apartment building is similarly disjointed. The glass entrance has been cracked since December, but there's a stupidly ornate chandelier in the lobby, refracting light on guests like confetti. The elevator hasn't worked in months. Abu Nabil, the building's cranky middle-aged super, lives in a small room next to the stairs. Someone decided to paint the stairwell a modern dark red, but then apparently changed his mind on Naj's floor, where the walls of the stairwell abruptly become beige. Each floor has two apartments facing each other, and Naj likes her neighbors, an elderly pair of widowed sisters who go out every Sunday in matching dresses and honest-to-God church hats. There's a hand-painted sign on her front door that reads, "Abandon all blank, ye who enter here," the space intentionally left bare for people to scrawl in things like Wi-Fi and bras. The sisters have never complained. Naj's apartment smells stale, like something yeasty left out too long with undertones of weed, even though she hasn't smoked in days. Near the window, an assortment of plants droop in various stages of dying. She always forgets about them. One second, she promises them, then trots to the kitchen and fills a mug. She goes from plant to plant, watering the dusty soil. "You get water, you get water, you get water," she sings out like Oprah. The water bubbles in the soil, then starts to drip onto the windowsill underneath. The plants remind her of her mother, of the swampy smell that she'd bring home with her after a day at the greenhouse. The apartment is a three-bedroom, too large for her, but over the years, the rooms have filled of their own volition with guitars and clothes and hosted a succession of friends who'd left their exes. The electricity cuts off most afternoons and the balcony rail squeaks anytime someone leans on it. The water runs hot for only a few minutes at a time, but she loves it. And more than that, she loves the idea of herself as loyal to modest living. The apartment represents her restraint. She could buy in one of the high rises, but doesn't. Her band's ethos is folksy. Naj had once been called the proletariat's duchess on the cover of a European music magazine. The amount of money in her Crédit Libanais account embarrasses her. Her father was furious when she bought the apartment. She was only 24, flushed from the surprising success of their first album proposal. It hadn't reached the United States, but sold well in Europe, taking off like a rocket in random cities, Amman, Kosovo, Athens, Riyadh. What the audiences seem to have in common, mused the Guardian article she taped to the refrigerator, are places of censorship, corruption, oppression. The musical duo fronted by Naj, nay, Najla Esnasser, creates an album of defiance. With guttural lyrics, powerhouse performances, and most compellingly, a mixture of Arabic and English lyrics, so the listener might often be unsure of what is being said, but is happy to sing along. "This is stupid, Baba," her father had thundered on the phone. "Stupid. First you say you want to study in Beirut, stupid number one. Then you say, Baba, I can't live with Jiddo even though he is your grandfather, stupid number two. But okay, I pay for rent for an apartment 5 minutes from our family house. Then, stupid number three, you make some money from your little band. Okay, great. But instead of saving or investing, you want to buy your own apartment in Beirut. Baba, for what? For what? Stupid number four." "I thought that was stupid number three," Naj mocked. The little band had hurt. "Baba," her father continued, "it's like the saying we have in Arabic." "Oh my God," Naj grumbled. Her father had an irredeemable habit of quoting Arabic sayings in English. "A single mistake ensures a double misfortune." "Baba," Naj interrupted, "I get it. Okay, I'm making a mistake." "A stupid mistake," he corrected. "A stupid mistake, fine. Except I don't think so. I don't have to pay taxes over here, and my friend Joe knows a good real estate agent. It's going to be fine. Can you try to be happy to me? Just practice it." She is the only one who can get away with talking to her father like this. "It's not that hard. Naj, congratulations," she said. "Oh my gosh, thank you so much, Baba. Come on, your turn." Her father only repeated, "A double misfortune." But the grave prediction had not come true. No disaster had befallen the apartment. Sure, the bathroom leaks during rainstorms and she can't fully close one of the bedroom windows. Sure, twice the gas from the stove has leaked, and the last time forcing the paltry fire department of Beirut to break her door open while the neighbors complained. But if Naj felt a slight unease whenever a doorknob literally fell out in her hand or a bathroom mirror cracked, she pushed it out of her mind, scolding herself for being superstitious like her sister, who sprinkled salt on her children's heads when they were babies and always enters airplanes with her right foot. Naj had purchased the apartment 5 years ago. Her father has only visited once. He shrugged after walking around the rooms and said aloud to the coat hanger as though Naj weren't there, "She overpaid for it." She would have paid double. She loves the apartment. It was the first place outside of the California house she grew up in that became truly hers. She steps out of her sneakers now at the bedroom door, a vestigial holdover from her mother's reign. "No shoes in the house. What are we, Americans?" The floor cool and dusty beneath her bare feet. By the time she's gargled mouthwash, rinsed her face, and heaved a pile of clothes off her bed, the sun has begun to rise, pastel as a baby blanket. Naj falls onto the bed with a sigh. She'll deal with her parents later this morning. She'll come up with a story. Everything will eventually work out. From the street below, there are sounds of awakening. A car engine starting, someone talking to a child. A female neighbor's voice rises up, "Bonjour," and Naj falls asleep.
Thank you so much for sharing that.
Thank you.
First off, let me say that I absolutely loved reading this book and meeting the Nasser family, Naj and all the others, and Beirut. Although I've never been, I feel like I can smell the almond trees when I'm reading it.
So. Thank you. I really appreciate that.
So tell me a little bit about how you came to this family and this story.
Yeah, I mean, I had a dream, which sounds ridiculous and like I made it up, but I had a very vivid dream around the time that I was trying to get Salt Houses. Like, we had found a publisher, but we're doing edits and whatever. And I had this super vivid dream about a Syrian woman. I essentially dreamt the plot of Mesna, who's the mother, like a Syrian woman in Damascus who desperately wanted to be an actor and did did theater acting in these on these small stages, and then moved to California, but it didn't work out. And then kind of like her aging, and she was like devastated. It was like very, very, it was like I was the woman and I was watching the woman. It was kind of a movie. Point is, I woke up and I'm an active dreamer. I've always been, but this was like, rarely does a dream make coherent sense from beginning to end. And I woke up and was like, give me my laptop, and just like typed out everything I could remember. And sent it to my brother right away. And it was this like 10-page document. He was like, I don't know what this is. Is this a summary? What is this? I was like, I don't know. And then I went back to just, you know, I kind of put it to the side, went back to the edits and everything I was doing, and then launching the book and everything that comes with that. And then the whole time I kept thinking about, like, I would come back and think about the woman. And when the time came to think about a long form project, because I'd been working on short stories that felt more manageable while I was figuring out what to do with Salt Houses, I found myself being like, I think this woman plays some sort of central role. And I had also been working on short stories about the expat community in Beirut, and both meaning like, you know, the expats that are foreigners and white people, whatever, but also the expats that are like the Americanized Arabs, the folks that go to study a semester to learn Arabic or whatever, or to brush up on Arabic. And I just was like, maybe there's a way to marry these two. And actually Naj was kind of the connective tissue there, because I knew I wanted a character that had been there for a long time in modern Beirut. And then I was like, well, what if Mesna was the mother? And then kind of from there started brainstorming and fleshing out the other family members. Yeah.
That is fantastic.
Yeah, I know. It's also not, I've been talking about it the last couple of weeks, and it's like, that's not my life. I don't just like dream. Like, I'm not just like sitting around dreaming plots of things. That would be lovely if I were, but it's definitely an unusual story.
For all the aspiring writers out there.
Exactly. Yeah. Just don't worry about it. Just dream it. Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit more about the research that you had to do for a work like this that is spanning place and age and time and experience?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where I think I've been saying this, like the civil war, any civil war anywhere, there are going to be different versions of what happened. And I think in Beirut, in Lebanon, if you ask several different people what started the civil war, for example, you'll get several different answers. I think that's very normative for a place that had like intra-group fighting. So I relied on primary and secondary sources. Like, I definitely spoke to folks that were there. I spoke to folks that left because Mesna and her husband, so the parents leave, like they immigrate to the States in like 78 or something like that. The Civil War lasted until 1990. So people who watched were from the region, but then watched the conflict and the war and the death and destruction from afar. And that's a very particular experience. And then people that were there the whole time, that's a very particular experience. And also just supplemented with more like kind of dry history and just like trying to get a sense of exactly what happened. And I am someone that lived in Lebanon for 8 years, and there was still a lot to learn and a lot to uncover. There was a lot of research too in just like old Hollywood, because Mesna was like very obsessed with that. So that was really fun. Like, just kind of like, who were the actors and actresses that she would have been like really drawn to? What were the movies that would have made her want to be on the screen? Like, things like that were really, it was very enjoyable.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And sort of relatedly, both of your novels span generations, time, and space. In addition to all the research you're having to do here, how are you weaving those stories together? And what draws you to that kind of storytelling in particular?
I think that it is, you know, there's the third novel I started writing. I stopped around the time the lockdown began, and I started working on nonfiction. I'm trying to get back into it now, but it was supposed to be a really present day, straightforward, and I just just kept slipping the past in and kept being like, how did we get here? What are the, you know, like, I think what draws me to those stories is I do not think any of us exist in a vacuum. And I do not think any of us we are not made in isolation. And our fears and our hopes and our joys, they are so deeply connected to what we come from. And that's not to say that I recognize that everybody is born into a biological family, for example, but like what we come from, both in terms of that, in terms of like biology and that, but also like what we inherit from the people that we grow up with, the caretakers, the siblings, the neighbors, the family, you know, the friends, the whatever. It's like that imbues everything that we do and see, you know, in a way that feels undeniable for me. So I have a very hard time doing like more plot or structurally simple present, like just present day, stay in this moment. We're not going back. We're not going forward. There's just something really delightful for me about being like, okay, here you have this like 29-year-old who drinks too much and does too much drugs and is like philandering. How does that connect it to her mother? Like, what is it about her mother's life, her mother's disappointments? How did that play out in their life when they were growing up that would result in this? I'm always like thinking about how we get there.
Yeah, I love it. I love to read your stories for all of the reasons that you described. when you're writing, and you are sort of writing one person's story, or, you know, as I'm turning the page, I'm like, oh, when are we getting to so-and-so story next? Do you find yourself with a favorite character or plot line?
That is a good question. I think Naj might be my fave. I think because I love Mesna. I love the mother. She's the one I spend the most time with, or the readers in some ways spend the most time with, because we the past stories are all from her perspective, right? And then the present, you start to divide it just among the adult children. But I think Najla was the most fun to write because she allowed me to go back to Beirut and also to go back to a very specific, like, kind of like an artsy going out, like intellectual drinking, like just like a very particular subculture of Beirut that I miss very desperately. And so she allowed me to get in touch with certain parts of myself that the other characters, they asked for different things of me, but there was something fun about like living in her sort of messed up world for a bit.
And in writing about the, you know, Naj's story versus Mesna's story, is writing about the past versus the present one more difficult than the other, one more fulfilling than the other?
It's a good question. I mean, I think writing about the past is more difficult because there's more research. So if I'm writing Naj's section in the present day, I visit Beirut relatively often. Like I feel like pretty confident taking that on. Or like Ava grows up or is currently in Brooklyn. Like one of the characters is like in Brooklyn with her partner and her kids and whatever. And I'm like, I can write about Park Slope. So I do think there's a part of it that's the present is easier because there's less like actual historical research that I have to do and making sure that I'm being true to the history and kind of like doing a service to these stories. But I do think that also in some ways makes it more fulfilling because if you can, my aim is to like evoke a world in the 70s that feels true to not just like, you know, a person that like has nothing to do with Beirut or like has never like, you know, I was not in Lebanon in the 60s or the 70s or whatever. But to make it true to someone who's like lived in Beirut in 1978 to read it and be like, yeah, you know what, this isn't bad. Like that's the most fulfilling thing ever.
Great. And can you talk a little bit more about why you chose the Civil War to sort of be the driver of this family's particular story?
I think there was no other way to do. I mean, I think one of the questions that Ruman asked, or Ruman Alam did my launch with me, and one of the things he asked was, he was like, is it like, did you use the Civil War to tell the story of the family? Which was an interesting question. And it was like, well, no, I mean, there would be no family without, like the story of the family wouldn't have been that story. Like in some ways, to tell the story of the family means to have to tell the story of the Civil War. Like anyone, you know, these are characters that Mesna grew up in Syria. Idris, the father, grows up in Lebanon. The Civil War happens. Like there's no way to kind of talk about the displacement and all of the things that, and all the choices that they end up making and the choices that their children then end up making without having the Civil War be a feature of it. And if I mean, in a lot of ways, I've like totally said this a million times, but this does feel like a love letter to Beirut, this book, in a lot of ways. And you can't tell the story of Beirut, unfortunately, without telling the story of the Civil War, the same way you can't tell the story of the United States without telling the story of like slavery and all the things that have happened in this history. It's not that it's only defining feature, but it is an important one. It is one that has shaped a lot of like the modern day problems that the country faces. And so, yeah, I think there was no way to write about those places without writing about the conflict.
Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about the opening line of the book, which, no spoilers here, is "Tonight the man will die." And indeed, the shadow of this man hangs over the book and the characters in the book in a way that the shadow of another young man hangs over salt houses. And I really loved that. And I was really transfixed by both men and their stories. And I wonder if you could just talk about that decision.
Alex, you were the first one to ask that. I don't know if you're the first one to catch it, but you're the first one to ask it. And yeah, it's really, and can I tell you something? I was halfway through writing Arson of the City before I realized that I'd done that. So clearly there's something I need to look at about these like men that like leave in their, like die in their 20s and then like cast this long shadow across generations. It was like, I was well into the writing of it where I was like, hang on a second. It's not a brother, but like there's something here. Like, I think that I remember as a kid being really transfixed and hyper aware and fascinated by the characters. I'm even calling them characters. That's a real writer's thing to say. By the humans in my family who were either died young or who were no longer around, like we didn't have access to them or whatever. So like the great aunts, you know, like my grandmother had a sister who died in her, I think, early 30s or something like that, and would always talk about how she was like so beautiful and so kind and such a heart of gold and such a, and I can think of several folks like that where just their stories and the space that they took up was like more than human sized space. Like their absence and their loss became like, it like took up all the air in the room sometimes, not in a bad way, just in like they were there and their stories always felt like on the tip of the tongue of like the people that were remembering them. And just as a kid kind of being like, wow, look at how someone cannot be here with us, either literally or metaphorically, and still be so important and still be like having such a tremendous effect on the family, you know? So I think that's all, I think I've just like always been interested both in like the people that are here and the people that are not, and what does someone's absence do to everyone that they leave behind, you know, and even the people that never knew them. So that's like, I'm really interested in like now fast forward two generations, what are the consequences then of that loss?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
So we've talked a little bit about your human characters. I'd love to talk about sort of the non-human characters in the book. The epigraph even says, how alive the city is, how alive, how alive, how alive. Beyond Beirut and Damascus, there is the family house itself, which is always capitalized when Mesna is talking about the house. And they all felt so alive and so real to me. And their stories felt like as real as, you know, Mimi or Ava's stories. And I wondered if you could talk about that a little bit, how you brought these city and the house to life.
That is such a beautiful question. I think also it's true to the way I am in the world. Like I think that I think of physical space being as just as elemental, and this might be a Palestinian thing. It might be like a, there's a little bit of like an obsession with space and what do you own? What do you not own? What do you have access to? What do you not have access to? So maybe it's that I'm paying more attention to those things than like the average person. But I do think the physical space as like having a personality and having a whole history and like there you can engage with it and like have a discourse with it the same way that you can engage and have a discourse with nature. Like it is its own, things have happened here. Like I think about like my grandma's apartment or whatever, it's like things happened there, people lived there, there were like loves and joys and heartbreaks and like it meant something, and that space carried it all and it saw it all. And I think that there's, I just think that that's, it's just kind of how I go through the world. And I am not someone that like feels like cities are passive. They're not. I find them to be incredibly dynamic and like just total life forces that have their, again, they have their quirks. They have like their, they like, every city kind of like has its smell or has the, like has a way it smells in October, you know what I mean? Or like has a certain like a way that it feels when there's a storm coming or when people are sad, or like there's just something about all those like environmental cues that I think some people are just kind of more attuned to it, again, probably because there is this like searching of like, where do I belong? Where can I like, you know, be like, I belong here. I love this place. This is my home. So I might just be kind of, I don't know. I might be looking out for it more.
That's lovely. You touched on, it's related. You touched on Beirut and your love of Beirut and your relationship with Beirut earlier. And I wonder, you know, my question is what makes Beirut and Damascus special to you and choosing to center those? I mean, obviously primarily Beirut, but Damascus plays a role as well.
Damascus does. Damascus, I have not spent that much time in. I've visited a few times, but have not like, we lived there when we left Kuwait when I was like 4. And then I went and visited a few times when I was in Beirut, but I don't know it very well. My grandmother was Syrian. She's from Latvia. But she spent a fair amount of time in Damascus. And I think when I was trying to think of where I wanted Mesna to be based, Damascus, just with all that it offered and what was going on then at the time, it just felt like it was the most appropriate setting. Beirut in particular is, I mean, lived in Lebanon for 8 years, went to AUB for 4 of them, the American University there. And it's because of my grandparents having lived there and friends and extended family and whatever, it was a place where from up until like my late 20s, I was going back twice a year and then started going back once a year, sometimes would skip a year, but still pretty regularly. It's the place that I feel most at home and a place that I know really well, even though it's always changing. It's always like a landscape that's like rapidly changing. It's not that similar from like, I was gonna say New York, from any place actually, everywhere's rapidly changing. But there is just a, even talking about it, it's like hard to articulate what it is, but there is something about Beirut that like, it is the keeper of a part of my heart and probably will be forever, which just makes everything that happens there that much more devastating when the country is suffering. Yeah.
One thing that I found really interesting in the choice of Beirut was just the convergence of so many people and identities on the streets, Lebanese, Syrian, Palestinian, Christian, Muslim. It was a wonderful setting rife with possibilities, I guess, for...
Totally, yeah. I mean, I think that's, so that would have been the better answer to the question. Yes. So in terms of like the writing and like why choose a location like that, aside from my personal feelings, it is also like an incredibly vibrant place that has a tremendous amount of history and a lot of people crammed together in a very small space, which is both been a powder keg situation in certain moments in history and also been like really remarkable moments of people coming together in other moments. So it is kind of like, I'm very, like, I was also wanting to write a story. You know, there's a character that I think still is kind of like a main character who's Palestinian, and there's a character that's main character that's Syrian and a character that's Lebanese, and the relationship between those three countries and like what they have done for each other, what they have not done for each other, what they have taken in when one country is, you know, wounded or bleeding. I think that also felt like really important and really, like, really fertile to like place characters there.
Yeah. Great. Can you talk a little bit more about the house's centrality to the book and the story, the ancestral home?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think everything kind of begins and ends with the house. Like it's in some ways, just from its dry writerly plot perspective, it is the driving force of the story, right? Like it's the thing that happens is that the father decides that he's going to sell the house. And in doing that, that is the motivating factor for everybody to gather. So from like a plot perspective, it was necessary because you need some reason for everybody to gather. But then I think also there's something about, And I think this is true for a lot of folks that grew up back and forth between the Middle East. I mean, I guess between the States and forever, but in my case, like the States and the Middle East, where these places become really, they become touchstones and they become really, really valuable. And for me, I didn't realize how central they were until my grandmother died and her house emptied out. And I never had really thought about like how central it was. And then like going back and seeing it once it had emptied out was brutal. And like, actually there was like a single chair that was decaying. That was the only piece of furniture in the entire like house. And I was like, okay, this is too much. And like someone had put cigarette butts in her flower beds. It was just like, there was something really devastating about it. And seeing the rooms emptied and dusty and uncared for, it was like seeing a loved one or like an old friend just in like a horrible condition. And it just made me realize how I was like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do with all the memories that I have in this place when this place is no longer there to remind me of them or to be like, again, like kind of an environmental like vessel for it. And I think that was what woke up the idea also for that being used in the book, because I just kept thinking like these adult children, the two older, aside from Naj, they born and raised in the States. Like they don't actually live in Lebanon, but they go in the summers, and the going in the summers and the hanging out at the grandparents' house and hanging out in this ancestral house, like it becomes a really big part of their identity. And there's a reason why the idea of selling this house, even though some of them haven't been there in years, is so upsetting. Because there's something about what it meant and carried for the family as, again, as like a receptacle of memory.
Yeah. And that really flows into another question I had, which is the idea and the reality of identity and diaspora seem really central to your work. And can you talk about that?
I mean, I'm obsessed with memory. Like I'm obsessed with what it does to us. I'm obsessed with how the obsession with it can ruin your life, because if you're also too nostalgic, that's not great either. About what, like how it can ruin your life to both try to avoid and push away memories of things, and also to like kind of be like, don't go, and like try to clasp onto them. I'm also really interested in the fact that our memories are super unreliable, and like some crazy percentage of the things we remember are blatantly false. it's just that we tell the story of a memory after it happens. And then we're telling ourselves the story of that story and then the story of that story. It's like a photocopy of a photocopy. It's like the final image is like something completely different than what was the literal thing that was data being inputted into your system. And I find that as it connects to displacement to be fascinating. Yeah. Because when you are an immigrant or, you know, the child of an immigrant or whatever, it's so your home, your land, your place is not something you have access to anymore in a lot of situations, especially people fleeing like turmoil or whatever. And your home becomes the memory. Like your home becomes like the memories that you have or the memories you inherit from your parents, which is another interesting thing of like those of us that have longing for places that we didn't go to or barely spent time in. It's that sort of like inherited memory, honestly, is how I think the lineage gets to stay alive in the face of displacement.
Yeah. So as folks may be able to tell, in addition to being a novelist, you're also a clinical psychologist and a renowned poet. So I'm wondering how those aspects of your life find their way into your novel writing, into your storytelling.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think there's a way for sure in which just being trained to be a psychologist helps you. It teaches you what questions to ask. It teaches you to be on the lookout for things like, you know, everyone's always, you know, doing something that's not in their best interest. That's kind of a human thing. You know, we're always making those mistakes or getting caught in cycles that are not like the best for us. And therapy training it helps you have empathy for people that are stuck in that. And it helps you ask the questions of like, why would someone do something that's not in their best interest? Like what are the other things that happen? How big of a motivator is fear here? How big of a motivator is desire or wanting or whatever? So I think it helps ask questions of your clients that in my case, then I just asked of my characters. So I think that helped tremendously. And there's something about attention. Like I've been talking about this, but I feel like I haven't been able to articulate it properly. Like there's something about how clinical psych training teaches you that the best, like your best tool as a therapist is your attention. It's being able to focus simultaneously on like the gestalt, like the global cohesive picture of the person, and also the specificity of what they're coming in without sacrificing one or the other. And again, kind of a crucial skill for writing. Like you want to always have the frame or the overall plot or shape of the thing that you're working on to be in the back of your mind without only serving that God, so to speak, right? Like you're also trying to serve the granularity of that specific moment that your character is in and doing right by that moment. So it's like, there's a lot of like holding two spaces at once that I think that both require of you.
And I have to say, this weekend I was doing a little bit of research and I stumbled upon you doing a live poetry reading on YouTube. Totally blown away. Fantastic, everybody. Check out the poetry as well as the novel.
Thank you so much.
Can you talk a little bit about how the novel writing may or may not help the poetry, vice versa? How are they different? How, you know?
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that the novel writing helps the poetry. I think it's helped the poetry in that it's helped me be more experimental with poetry. Like it's helped me write more prose poetry and kind of be like, it doesn't have to have a particular structure. It can be more expansive and open. And then I think the poetry has helped the fiction. I mean, I wrote much more. I published in poetry way before I published in fiction. And I think that I was more polished in poetry before I was polished in fiction. Like I just kind of felt more like that was my thing first. And I think that meant that when I sat down and started working on fiction and prose in general, I brought to the table like a poetic sensibility, which is kind of means nothing. But what I mean by it is like an ability and an interest in really getting specific. So if it's like describing an emotion, it's not just saying angry. It's like, what does that feel like? Where are we seeing it? What's happening in like the character's chest or their stomach or the, like there's a real specificity that poetry asks of you. There's a real, I guess the word granularity comes up again. There's a real granularity to what poetry asks of you that translates nicely into fiction in that you, I've said this before, but I kind of think fiction, like a novel is like a million little poems. If you're just like focusing on minute after minute, after minute, after minute, and then there's like kind of this cohesive pull at the end of it. So I've been really well served by working in different genres. I'm very grateful that that's something that I was like interested in learning how to do.
Yeah. So what's next for you? You mentioned earlier some fiction, some nonfiction.
Yeah. So when lockdown happened, the day lockdown happened was the last day I worked on this novel. Oh. Just ridiculous. It's been a year. And I think what happened is there was something about the intensity and the urgency of the moment that made me be like, I can't do nonfiction, like, or fiction. I can't, like, get something in my imagination where I was like, I can't be living in a fictional world. This one is too, like, it's screaming for my attention. And I started working on some nonfiction instead. And so I have this book that will be coming out with Simon & Schuster. I don't know exactly when. It's still not fully written, but it's basically a cultural memoir on the concept of erasure and how erasure is something that happens from the outside in to certain communities and marginalized folks, and then also how that erasure can be internalized by people. So like there are a multitude of ways that we erase ourselves through eating disorders, through codependency, through substance abuse, through, like, you know what I mean? So it's kind of like the different ways that that can happen. And then the novel, which I'm happy to say I'm rereading and I'm getting back into, is a story of a woman who leaves, she's an Arab American who lives in Savannah and then leaves and moves to Paris for 10 years after her roommate gets murdered. And I know, real left turn. I know. Really, I was like, you know what? No more family stories. But it ended up kind of being a family story. but basically her roommate gets murdered in college and she sort of like, it's just too much. And she kind of goes to Paris to start over and start a new life. And then something pulls her back to her hometown in her mid-30s. And she's kind of becomes entangled in trying to figure out what happened to her roommate.
I'm intrigued.
It was really fun to write. Yeah, I'm excited to get back into it, actually.
And we're adding a, you know, nonfiction author to your already impressive resume. Oh, gosh. So I know we're hitting the time when we also want to open it up to some audience questions. So if folks want to use the Q&A at the bottom of your screen to ask some questions, I'll be happy to read those. And while we await one of those, I have to ask about the role of the arts. I was really taken by the fact that, as you've touched on, Mesna was a theater, an actor in the theater, was aspiring to do film. Najla is a maestro and a rock star. Mimi is an aspiring rock star. Talk about that.
I mean, to be honest with you, in Salt Houses, I was really I was confined by history. And it's like, what did the people who were actually confined in history feel? but I was a little bit like, hands were a little bit tied in terms of like, the characters had to live in certain places with certain amounts of resources at in a certain era. And so it wouldn't have been realistic for me to have like a first, like, you know, someone that newly immigrated to the States be like, I'm going to be a rock star. That's why I'm coming here. I'm not sure I'm going to make ends meet, but I'm going to like go pursue my, that's not generally how it happens. Because I don't spend as much time in modern day as I do in the second novel in Arsonist City. So when I got to Arsonist City, I was like someone who was set wild and free in the world. And I was like, they can have whatever careers I want them to have. I can do whatever I want. These are kind of like spoiled Americanized Arabs who have like their dad's a doctor and they have a certain amount of resources and they're kind of all just like adult children. So I can, you know, and so I was like, what are things that I've always been like, that would be so cool to be. And I'm like, being a musician, that's successful, would be really cool to be. Being an actor would be really cool to be. And being an actor that failed at it would be really interesting. Not necessarily, I wouldn't want that, but I think what it does to you to really be passionate. I think art is really interesting, where it's like really wanting something to work in an artistic endeavor and then not having the result happen, what that does to the process. Because there are a lot of people that are like, yeah, I kind of suck at this thing, but I love it. And there are people that like are like, didn't get the book published, never writing another word. And I like, what happens in someone's psychology to make you land on either end of that spectrum is really interesting to me. And I also like had her work in a greenhouse. So I was like, it would be so cool to work in a greenhouse. I honestly was just like, what would be cool things to write about?
That's the power that you have as the author.
Yeah, I can make him do whatever I want.
Yeah. Oh gosh, very good. Someone leaving a comment that we're all the end result of our lifetime experiences, knowingly.
Totally.
Yeah, it really feeds into this work. I'm wondering if you can talk about the women in the book in particular. All your characters are so strong and are just so well fleshed out, but the women in particular, you just kind of fall in love with them, flaws and all.
Thank you. I mean, I think the women, I do think I end up giving the women more airtime because I think I'm just more interested. I think they're like, I did not grow up with a ton. So I'm going to say this and it's going to make it sound like I did it for that reason. I'll get to that. What I was going to say is I did not grow up with a ton of representation of like Arab American women who were also like out having a drink or having sex or, you know, like living life. And I also did not grow up with a lot of representation of like Arab women, like older Arab women who also had like a range of desires and made mistakes and had affairs and like got like, you know, like made bad choices and were three dimensional in that way. And so I think I've been really drawn in the last like 10 years as more of that representative literature has come out by different authors, been really drawn to that. So I think that kind of laid the foundation subconsciously for like, I really want to have fully fleshed out three-dimensional Arab female characters in particular. It's not like a mission statement that I'm going for, but it's just kind of like what my heart leads me to that. And also I think there's utility in that because representation is very important right now. Yeah.
Thank you. Question, you mentioned spending time in Beirut and Damascus and Kuwait, asking where all you grew up.
Yeah, so I basically, in terms of languages, English and in Arabic, and then some French. French is okay. If I'm in Paris for a while, French is good. In terms of where, so I was born in Carbondale, Illinois, and I lived there for the first week of my life. And then we went back to Kuwait, which is where my parents were living. And then I was in Kuwait until the Gulf War, or the invasion, technically. And that I had just turned four. And we had to leave my father behind for a few months. And so my mom and I went to my mother's family in Syria for several months. And then they sought asylum in the States, which is where my maternal aunt, happened to have just moved separately from the invasion. Her and her husband had just moved to Norman, Oklahoma. So they were granted asylum, went to Norman, Oklahoma, lived there for a year, lived in Texas for a year, went back to Oklahoma and lived for, I guess, like 4 or 5 years, and then lived in Maine for a year, really random places. And this was based on like where my parents were like getting graduate degrees and whatever. And then we moved back to the Middle East when I was 12. And we lived in the Gulf for a while. We lived in Tripoli. We lived in a mountainous area called Bramana in Lebanon. And then I did my undergrad in Beirut. And then I moved here for grad school, and I've been here since.
So many places, lots of settings for future.
Yeah, a lot of places, definitely.
So Mitch asks, he notes you spoke about erasure earlier, and he wonders if there are things you want to write about but won't or can't for reasons that you both understand or might not understand.
That's a really good question. I've started to write more about sex, but that, like Salt Houses doesn't have a lot of sex. The Arsonist City has more sex. And I do think that was because for the first book, I was like, oh my God, my dad might read this at some point. Like there was just like the idea of like, and it's not even, my dad is like, fine. He's like, he's fine, you know, but there's just, there are, I think, some cultural norms of like, my uncles could read, like there was a little bit of that. But that's, I'm definitely feeling more comfortable with that now. I'm uncomfortable writing about, I really like that. Is it Anne Lamott? Who's the person that said, if people wanted you to write nicer things about them, they should have behaved better?
Yeah, I don't know, but yeah.
A nonfiction writer. And I was like, oh my God, I love that. So I like that. And I ascribe to that in theory, but in actuality, as I'm writing more nonfiction, I'm really struggling with writing about like people that didn't consent to be written about, or like my family who are always like, we'll murder you if you ever write anything about it. So like there's, I'm like, I don't know why I'm ambivalent about it. Like, I think there is a little bit of like, I don't know. I feel kind of like I have to be mindful of that. And that's been really tricky because it's hard to write freely about my stuff without writing. I'm again, not made in a vacuum, don't exist in isolation. So there's been some negotiation around that for sure.
Yeah. Well, that leads really nicely into a question we have from Jacqueline, who asks, does your family read your books? And how does your relationship with them impact the way that you depict family relationships?
I mean, listen, there's definitely some like family dynamics that end up getting replayed in some of these books, for sure. I think I hyperbolize. So I think like I'll take things and quirks and whatever in my family, and I'll be like, it'd be really funny if we blew that up, or we got like almost like a caricature of that. I also have to be mindful not to have any character be too similar to a family member because of the aforementioned threat of murdering me. Yeah, so I have to be mindful of that. But there are definitely some dynamics, like mother-daughter dynamics, sibling dynamics, that just the sort of general thing between them, I can kind of like play with. And it often is based on things that I've experienced. My family has read my book. Actually, my first reader for both was my brother, yeah, who I very like adore and like really rely on his taste. And then for The Arsonist City, actually, no, I'm lying. My brother was one of the first readers for The Arsonist City. The first one was my dad, aside from the folks, like the wonderful, amazing people like Houghton Mifflin and whatever. It was my father. And he, you know, he didn't say anything about the sex scenes. And he just kind of gave feedback about some of the political stuff and like was like, hey, you missed this, you missed that, beautiful story. And like had a lot of like really lovely things to say about it. So they do read it, and they're actually incredibly supportive.
That's so great.
Yeah, I'm really lucky, yeah.
They must be so proud. Naomi asks, how do you think the different characters are spending lockdown? They seem like they'd struggle in different ways being stuck at home.
Oh my God. Also, Naomi Gibbs is my amazing editor. Hi, Naomi.
Good question.
Amazing question. Wish you'd given me a heads up because I thought of like a more cool answer.
Angling for a secret.
I think, yeah, exactly. This is actually one of the best questions I've asked in a really long time. I think that Mesna and Idris are fighting. I think that Naj has decided to try to be sober, and it's in varying degrees of success. I think that Ava is being driven crazy by homeschooling her kids. And I think that Mimi is cooking a lot, like cooking up a storm and like making solo music now.
Yeah, good. Good for Mimi. I want to try his food so badly.
I know.
Oh gosh. All right, we've got a question here from Dennis who asks, is it more fulfilling to have a character based on any personal experiences or to only use research and creativity?
That's a great question. I think, I don't know how to do the lad. Well, actually, no, I see what you're saying. Like I thought it was just research. So research and imagination.
Right.
I think the latter is more challenging. And so there's something really fulfilling and enjoyable about that. But there is something fun about being able to say, I know exactly what this feels like. And now I have to come up with an inventive way to make the character experience that. But tweak it to their particular, because no character is a copy of it, right? So it's like, but tweak it to their circumstances, to their temper or their recent whatever conversation with their partner. Like, there's something really fun. I think both require a certain amount of like inventiveness and creativity, but the latter definitely is just like, it's more challenging.
Yeah. Dennis also asks if you prefer writing novels or poetry. Do you prefer one to
the other? That's a great question. Poetry is easier because it's like instant gratification and you write it and you're like, look at my poem, and people can pat you on the back. A novel takes forever and is like, there isn't really that instant gratification. I mean, there's gratification, but by the time you hold the book in your hands, it's an amazing feeling, but also like, it's probably been a couple of years and like, it's, you know, I think I like the relationship I have with poetry in that I trust it more and I can just wait to be inspired. I don't have to babysit my poetry. I can like, I'm like, I won't write poems for months and I'm like, it's fine. I think the relationship with fiction is more, I think I would say, actually funny enough, I think I would say it's the one that's more deeply gratifying because that's the one that it's harder, but when things click, you're more like, oh my God, I can't believe I managed to make all of these characters work, or I can't believe I figured out this like plot hole, or I can't believe I whatever. It's sort of like more marathon versus sprint. And I think you feel better when you're done with a marathon. I've never done one, but yeah,
I would have no idea.
But. I don't know. I'm guessing. I don't know.
Kiki says, hello, you're awesome. Can you tell us a bit about your process of choosing the characters' names?
Kiki, I love you and you're awesome too. And Kiki's my friend. I'm not just like randomly saying that. So really inappropriate. So I love picking names. I actually just go to baby name websites and we'll just like say the name aloud and think about how it sounds in dialogue. And then think this family was fun because I came up with like a lot of nicknames too. So it's like, what kind of nicknames can we have for the characters? But yeah, it's basically just like looking at baby websites.
And Allison asks, what books have inspired you along the way?
That's a really good question. I mean, I always go back to like Jhumpa Lahiri, everything that she touches is gold, and I am down on one knee for her. And just like, I first read Interpreter of Maladies, I must have been like in my late teens, like probably like college. And ever since then, every few years, like something new would be released by her and it would just like completely upend my life in the best possible way. And she has a book coming out in a couple months, which I'm very excited about. So I think I would say like, if there was like one person that I think of as like a touchstone, it's probably Lahiri. Like, I think that the way that she just creates these really deftly done plots that are really complicated, but she does them really, she like delivers them in a way that feels deceptively simple. And she also has these really sweeping kind of multi-generational stories and is also someone who I think, I don't know, I'm obsessed with, I want to meet her someday. But it's like, I think also kind of has like some sort of fascination with like how the past impacts the present and will kind of have characters in the present have things happen to them that are very connected to like what happened 30 or 40 or whatever, 50 years ago. So yeah, that's definitely someone who's been really inspiring.
Great. All right. Scrolling through all these great questions. Mitch asks, have you ever read the work of Elias Corey? Thoughts? And ask if you have ambition to write the great Palestinian novel.
No, thank you. Because that's, I think actually like they've already been written. Like I'm good. I would not want that. Oof, that would be a lot of responsibility. I haven't read that. Wait, I want to see the name. Elias Khoury. Yes, of course. Sorry, Alex. I just didn't recognize. Yes, I have read Elias Khoury. I think a brilliant, brilliant writer, incredibly evocative, and I think really travels, I was going to say difficult subject matter, not necessarily difficult subject matter, but just very like loaded subject matter, really with a lot of tenderness, actually, like a lot of unexpected tenderness. So yes.
Great. And I think we have time for one more, and there's one more here. Clara says, I love the sibling relationship in The Arsonist City. How do these relationships help you as a writer capture the diaspora and first generation experience?
I am so sorry. I like for a second, this thing popped up on my screen and okay. The sibling relationship in The Arsonist City, how do these relationships? First of all, thank you so much. I loved writing the siblings because they were so bickery and like, oh, they were just like a blast to work with. I think there's something in the first gen, third culture kid, whatever, like where you kind of speak a separate language. You speak a different language from people who are not the kids of immigrants, and you speak a different language than those that are immigrants. And it's this sort of, and sometimes it's literally a different language, but what I mean is kind of metaphorically a hodgepodge of experiences. And there's a lot of emotional code switching that happens. And I think having siblings in a story like this helps because it gets to show you how that translates within the family. And it gets to show you how they are the keepers of each other's experiences. Like at the end of the day, your siblings, you know, broad brush. Okay, I'm painting with a broad brush, but like, often your siblings are the only other people that know the intricacies of what your particular household was like, you know, and so there is something very specific to that experience that in this case also includes the fact that they are like the kids of immigrants and their culture and all that.
Thank you so much.
Of course, thank you. Thank you to everyone who asked the question.
Yeah, and so just want to wrap this up. And again, thank you, Hello, so much for being here, for writing this beautiful works. Everybody, the book is The Arsonist City. There's a link in the chat to where you can buy the book and enjoy it. Check out her poetry as well. And we'll stand by waiting for your next two books.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Have a great night.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.